Good morning, everybody, here and on Zoom. This is case 46 from the Hekigan Roku, Blue Cliff Record. Jin King's Sound of the Raindrops. Introduction. With a single stroke, he completes it and passes beyond ordinary and holy. His slightest words can break things up, untying what is bound and releasing what is stuck, as if walking on thin ice or running over sword blades. He sits within the heaps of sound and form. He walks on top of sound and form. For the moment, I leave aside wondrous functioning in all directions. How is it when he leaves that very instant? To test, I'm citing this old case. Look. Jin King asked the monk, "What sound is it outside the gate?" The monk said, "The sound of the raindrops." Jin King said, "Sentient beings are inverted. They lose themselves and follow after things." The monk said, "What about you, teacher?" Jin King said, "I almost don't lose myself." The monk said, "What is the meaning of I almost don't lose myself?" Jin King replied, "Though it still should be easy to express oneself, to say the whole thing has to be difficult." The verse. An empty hole, the sound of raindrops, never ever interrupted. Everyone is here. If you say he's let the streams enter, as before, you still do not understand. Understanding or not understanding, on South Mountain or North Mountain, more and more downpour. So recently I got an interesting email for someone new who came to practice with us just a couple of times to see if Zen is a good fit for them. And in the email, this person said that they found the stillness and silence of our practice very challenging, and that they were looking for stimulating discussions that would shift the attention away from what's going on in their heads. In other words, looking for external distraction or an interesting displacement activity. And then they ended the email by saying that they would return if we decide to shift our practice from zazen and structured ceremonies to interesting group discussions. So here's what I wrote back. While there are many facets to Zen practice and its relevancy to our daily challenges, the main aspect of the tradition revolves around the cultivation of stillness and silence, learning how to be with ourselves in such an intimate way teaches us how to quell our restless mind and how to connect with the world in a much more beneficial way. Shifting our attention to other activities may feel good for short periods of time, but ultimately we cannot escape our own mind and we cannot avoid having to face ourselves. If at some point you arrive at this conclusion on your own, please reach out so we can set up a time and talk about a gradual way you can calm down the mind and cultivate a practice. So what I found is that what this person expressed is actually most common for all of us as human beings. We experience inner turmoil and restlessness as we encounter the challenges of our existence, everyday life. And since we often find it to be overwhelming, we naturally, and we have to emphasize naturally, look for escape routes, which obviously are plentiful in our fast-paced society. And we are surrounded by endless options to numb ourselves and to distract our attention away from the mind, which appear only to keep us in a state of hunger for further distractions. The more we run away, the more we want to run away. And sadly, our constant discontentment and underlying restlessness is also often what keeps the economy going. In other words, we are preyed on because of that. Ultimately, there is no such thing as successful escape or magic bullet kind of distraction that will put to rest the agitated mind. But unless we arrive at this conclusion on our own, we never stop seeking for one. We cannot read about this in a book or hear about it in discussion or from someone and think, well, this is a good idea. I'm going to take on this idea. It doesn't work. Now, the first ox herding picture, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, depicts the person who has realized that chasing after external stimulations and distractions does not work. And so they embark on a spiritual exploration that goes inwardly, opposite of what we may want to do often, right? To discover the source of the restlessness rather than escape it. And when we take time to study our own personal history in an earnest way, we see beyond the facade of glamorous advertisement, clever words in a book, or even the promise of a spiritual workshop. Then and only then, we can begin to develop a practice that's rooted in our inherent wisdom, or a practice that's rooted in what's real, in what is, not what is produced. And so studying ourselves is essential. In other words, we have to examine, we have to see what's going on. What have I been doing all these years? Has it been working or not? Did it produce anything other than more of the same? Did it solve anything? So we have to study ourselves, but also studying the way we are as human beings is essential. The way we are as human beings who seem to continuously gravitate towards aggression and conflicts. It's interesting that once in a while people ask me if the fact that human beings have always engaged in conflicts isn't a verification that it is the way we are by nature. Since dominance and self-centeredness are so prevalent, doesn't this mean that we are meant to be this way? It's a good question. It's a very sad question, but it's a good question. But if this was so, if this way of being was in accordance with our true nature, then most people would be utterly content and at ease with themselves. Content because they would be aligned. There won't be agitation. In other words, it would work. But it doesn't. So what we can learn by observing the way we have been acting as human beings is that chasing power, dominance, money, assets, recognition, or approval is fueled by habit energy, and ultimately it does not deliver. Don't take my words for it. Don't take words in the book for it. Examine. Study. Study yourself. Study your surroundings. Study our history. And ask, did it work? And we can see that chasing after external stuff does not put to rest the agitated mind. In fact, it is quite the opposite. It makes us more agitated and it wreaks havoc and much suffering, this way of being. As long as we don't know how to be quietly with ourselves and experience the deep support that stems from the simplicity of just being, the agitated mind will remain the dominant factor in our lives, and we will continue to engage with conflicts on a personal level, actually with ourselves, with our immediate surroundings, and on a much larger scale of groups fighting other groups or nations trying to annihilate other nations. It's the same principle, just magnified, exponentially magnified. So the sole fact that we have been acting this way throughout our history doesn't make it true. It's true, but it doesn't make that assumption true. It only reaffirms the physics of momentum or the power of perpetual karma. That it does. Which is good because we can study and understand how it works. And someone has to stop and take a look at these harmful ways. Someone has to do it. And if it's not you, then who? And if it's not now, then when? So a bodhisattva does not wait for the world to be sane. And so she takes the initiative to be radically different, to examine all fixed notions and go against the grain of habit, as challenging as this may be. Our agitated mind operates on an automatic mode, and it creates an underlying sense of discontentment, which often leads to impulsive speech and actions with harmful consequences. So if you take time to observe your mind on and off the cushion, you will find a direct link between the way it operates and the endless conflicts we perpetuate as human beings. This is actually very important, that we understand the connection between our own so-called personal experience of agitation and the consequences, its consequences. If we don't understand that, if we cultivate a practice just because I want to be calmer, because I want to experience some peace, and if it remains that way, it may start that way, but if it remains that way, then we fail to understand the connection between what we call me and what we call other. And if we fail to understand that, then the practice does not penetrate us. Then we use the practice in the same way that we use any other thing. And so when we don't know how to quell these powerful energies, they naturally become the predominant forces in all our interactions, from small to large scales. Yet, as powerful as these energies are, the simplicity of Zazen can help us realize a much greater power. During our last study session, we discuss the sense of spaciousness that becomes available and accessible through meditation and how it quiets down the agitated and impulsive mind and, of course, its aggressive tendencies. Now, during Zazen, we intentionally release our grip on any fixed notions about ourselves, about others, and about our reality. return to oneness as we chant, is a return to the vast spaciousness of unity that has no parameters or divisions. And then, when Zazen ends, we continue this immersion in a sense of totality, right? So everything is interconnected. So we can continue this practice of immersion by examining how we use our senses to interact with our immediate reality. How do we function? Well, how do we practice when we turn inwardly? And then, how do we continue that practice when we turn outwardly? Which is what this koan is asking us about. The teacher in this case is Jingqing Daofu, a 10th century Chinese Zen master, disciple of Xiefeng, Sepo. Based on recorded stories of his teachings, one of his favorite ways to test the depth of his disciples' understanding was to draw their attention to a sound and ask, "What is this sound?" In this particular case, Jingqing was having a dialogue with one of his disciples while it was raining. And so, referring to the rain, he asked, "What is that sound outside the gate?" And the footnote to this line says, "He actually lets down a hook. He does not suffer from deafness. What is he asking?" So he wasn't deaf or senile, and he knew exactly what was going on. So why would he ask such a question? This disciple naturally says, "It's the sound of the raindrops." And the footnote adds, "He's undeniably truthful." But conventionally, we don't raise questions about what is agreed to be common knowledge. We don't point to a tree, a cat, or a shirt in our closet and ask, "What is it?" Our everyday life relies on a basic structure that consists of set definitions and agreed upon notions about our immediate environment, which obviously provides a logical way for us to function in the world. And so, of course, it makes sense. But there's also the potential issue, or a potential arising issue, with this way of thinking, since our notions and definitions can appear to be portraying a complete and absolute image of reality, which, if it does, when it does, makes us very rigid and inflexible. And it can lead to self-righteousness, discrimination, violence, hatred, on and on and on. You can adjust your position if needed. So raising questions about what seems to be known facts has the power to puncture the absoluteness of it in our mind. And it can help us see beyond the fixed image we have formed about different appearances in our environment, and most importantly, about our own fixed image and the image of another. But to get there, we need to develop the willingness to let go of the known and willingly venture into the unknown by cultivating a continuous inquiry, a sense of curiosity. So there's a shift from a notion of knowing to an open-ended sense of curiosity. It's a big jump for us. So Jinking asked, "What is this sound?" And the monk answered, "It is the sound of the raindrops." Now there is a need for the question, and there is a place for this kind of an answer. But how do we understand the sound of the raindrops? Hakuin commented on this part, and he said, "Jinking was always fond of using this question. It contains the temporal and the true, the flowers and the moon, or the relative and absolute form and emptiness. The sound of raindrops, splash, splash, herein, there is the present moment and there is the other side, with temporal and true perception and function included together. The sound of the raindrops. There's more than one way to say it. There's more than one way to experience it. There are answers that end or kill open-ended curiosity, because they give the impression of knowing. They give us the impression of knowing. And then there are answers which may sound exactly the same, that do the opposite, that open it up. What's the difference? So if we don't see the true within the temporal, or the dynamic changeability within what seems to be solid, then we remain stuck in a repetitive pattern, even when it is causing pain and suffering. That's irrelevant. When you look at the indoctrination and hatred within certain factions in the Middle East, for example, you can see how stuck and unchanging it has been for so much time. And new generations just pick up the torch and continue along the path of hatred and destruction, being convinced that it must go on. And so nobody stops to raise the question, why are we doing this? We've been taught to hate. But why? Or is that the only way? Is it more than just momentum? We do have to ask ourselves on a regular basis. We have to ask questions. You know, because we often find ourselves, everybody does, we find ourselves in repetitive patterns every day. Life is changing and we're not. Life is changing. Every day is new. Yet our reactivities, our triggers are the same. Isn't that telling us something? Isn't that important to examine and to understand and to see the gap between our reactivities and reality itself? The more we perpetuate the repetitive patterns, the greater the gap that we create between ourselves or our existence and reality. And the greater the gap, the greater the suffering. That's the equation. And again, don't believe me. Or don't even believe what the Buddha said. Take a look, examine your life and ask, where are my repetitive patterns? And what perpetuates those patterns? What is it for the sake of? what is sustained by those patterns. So we have the responsibility, it is very important responsibility, to raise questions about what appears to be evident and convincing. Otherwise, our actions don't change and history repeats itself, right? As it does. So the monk says, it is the sound of the raindrops. And Jinking responded to him by saying, sentient beings are inverted. They lose themselves and follow after things. Jinking said this 1,000 years ago, yet it could not be more relevant to us today. Right? Our consumer-based society offers an endless array of rabbit holes to follow and lose ourselves into. And we do. We follow after things that do not deliver and only keep us in a continuous state of hunger for more, which works not for us, but for those who produce what we consume. And by doing so, we turn away from home. We lose touch with our true being. We lose touch with that that does deliver, that does give the support, that actually provides essentially what we're looking for. But unless we stop and turn it around and look, it's not going to end. Hakuin commented by saying, ordinary people are upside down. That is to say, in spite of the fact that speech itself, mountains, rivers, earth, and space in the 10 directions are only single Buddha nature, the flower ornament scripture says, having lost their real nature, they pursue objects in front of them. Having lost their real nature, or lost touch, having lost touch with their real nature, they pursue objects in front of them. It's very true, very real. When we're not in touch, we're not in touch with who we are. We become frantic. We feel lost. So naturally, we look for ways to cover it up, to quench this inner thirst. But having realized that it doesn't work, then something begins. Then we turn inwardly. And then we could see for ourselves. So the monk pressed further and asked, what about you, teacher? Do you lose yourself and follow after things? Jinking said, I almost don't lose myself. I almost don't lose myself. And the commentary on that says, you must realize that the ancient was using his probing pole and reed shade to see into the depth and to examine this monk. The monk too pressed back well, immediately saying, what about you, teacher? What happened then was that Jinking went into the mud and water to say to him, I almost don't lose myself. Now the reason for saying this was that the monk himself was losing himself, pursuing things. Why did Jinking lose himself too? You must realize that Jinking had a place to get out himself within the phrase he used to test the monk. So he had a way out. Now, the reality of form is not necessarily an issue. And sound or sights by themselves do not have the power to trap us. The question is, How do we function within it while being surrounded by all kinds of stimulations designed to target our sense of lack, designed to capture us when we feel lost, when we feel that, away from home, basically. And there is a way. There is a way to be in it without being attached to it. Jinking and this monk were both in the mud. But the difference is Jinking was free and the monk was trapped. Or we can say that there's more than one way to be here today. There's more than one way to interact with all our challenges. And that way does not mean eliminating or pretending or getting drunk. It's the opposite. It's actually turning inwardly so we can turn outwardly and then function without being so sticky, without being so reactive. But to do so, it takes verification on our own, verification of who we truly are by observation, and then the continuation of that into whatever challenge we end up facing. So Jinking used to do that in other situations, used to use that question. There are two other stories about that. One day he asked the monk, "What is the sound outside the gate?" And the monk said, it wasn't raining that day. The monk said, "The sound of a quail." Jinking said, "If you wish to avoid uninterrupted hail, do not slander the wheel of the true Dharma of the Tathagata." Another time, Jinking asked, "What is that sound outside the gate?" And the monk said, "The sound of a snake eating a frog." And Jinking said, "I knew the sentient being suffer. Here is another suffering sentient being." Was he referring to the frog? Or to the monk? Or was he just stating the fact, here is another suffering sentient being. Here is another suffering sentient being, right? What do we do with that? These are not dialogues or questions to ponder or to solve. These dialogues or these questions are meant to be one pointer, one sharp pointer that is designed for you to see you. So these words are the same as in this case. If patriot monks could penetrate here, the commentary says, nothing can block their independence within the heaps of sound and form. If you can't penetrate, then you are constrained by sound and form. So can we be at that state of almost not losing ourselves? And if we can do that, we don't have to go anywhere else or do anything else. Then it comes down to how we function. So Jinking said, "I almost don't lose myself." And the monk asked, "What is the meaning of I almost don't lose myself?" And Jinking replied, "Though it still should be easy to express oneself, to say the whole thing has to be difficult." And the footnote says, "Provisions to nourish a son." If he doesn't call it the sound of raindrops, what sound should he call it? It simply cannot be explained. And Tenke commented on that, saying, it is easier to relinquish everything, sound and form, right and wrong, to realize an untrammeled state of personal freedom. But total expression, saying it all without falling into verbal understanding of objects or intellectual understanding of mind, freeing it from the mold is something that is hard to do. Ultimately, the message is to detach from the totality without moving from there. This is Jinking's penetrating help for people. So to free ourselves from the mold, and this is, I think, an important point for all of us practitioners, because there is a structure of practice, and the structure is designed for us to see, to get in touch with our true nature. But it's very important to not grab a hold onto that or to become identified with that. It's very important to drop it completely and move on. And then let it, trust it, and let it function in our lives. Let it dissolve all this stickiness. The verse, an empty hole, the sound of raindrops. Never ever interrupted, everyone is here. How to respond, even for an adept. If you say, is ever let the streams enter, as before, you still do not understand. Now, understanding or not understanding, and the footnote says, cut off the two ends. The two are not separate. It's not on these two sides. So understanding or not understanding, on South Mountain or North Mountain, more and more downpour. Above our heads and under our feet, if you call it the sound of raindrops, you're blind. If you don't call it the sound of raindrops, what sound will you call it? Your feet must be treading the ground of reality before you can get there. Your feet must be treading the ground of reality. Realizing the absolute is not yet enlightenment. We chant. Right? So you have to be treading the ground of reality, not just realize it. Just finish with the introduction, which says, he sits within the heaps of sound and form. He walks on top of sound and form. And Hakuin's commentary. There is nothing in the world outside of sound and form. Even hells and heavens come from these two. If you can master this sphere, you gain great freedom, serene and peaceful indeed. Zen practitioners should be able to sleep in the midst of sound and form, should be able to sleep peacefully within this chaos. The hallmark of our practice revolves around the simplicity of stillness. Why? So we can personally experience the meaning of silent illumination. But it is not a conclusion or a cherished prize. We turn inwardly to reconnect with our true nature so we can put this out to practice, so we can put to rest the frantic sense of inner turmoil. And then we turn outwardly so we can flow through life with ease, genuine care, and deep appreciation. And it's a process of becoming less attached or triggered by external conditions. Less attached, less reactive, less prickly. So I'll leave you with this image. Imagine, think about a driftwood, right, in water, just a piece of wood that's been in the water for a long, long time. It's very smooth, right? Because the water has done that over time. So all the prickly points, right? Or the remainders of branches have been worn off. How does that move in water? Now think about this when it was first dropped in the water. Lots of stuff sticking out of it. It would flow in water and get caught up all the time by all kinds of stuff. That's the difference. That's us. Very prickly, very pointy, very unsmooth. So of course we get caught up. Of course we get irritated. Of course we jump up and want to retaliate because it hurts. But if we can practice and practice and practice and smooth it again and again and again and again, then we become like that. And we can flow like that, like this piece of wood in water, we can flow in life like that. Of course, creating a lot less suffering and become much more beneficial. So think of that in relation to your resolve. Think of that in relation to the moments that you may feel discouraged, deflated. You don't feel like practicing. You'd much rather do something else. Think of what that something else would be feeding. And what would practice be feeding? You have to realize that answer, because I can't give it to you. And if you do realize it, when you do realize it, then you also at the same time realize the great power within.